welcome to another edition of Money Talk. I'm Neil Kreisel and Diane Duva, and I, your host every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 11, and Saturdays at 6. We're brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending, whose highly trained and experienced team takes great pride in helping people with home financing, offering competitive rates and a wide array of loan programs. Alnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Cota Street in downtown Santa Barbara. At Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm in Santa Barbara, providing its clients with the personal care and attention of a small independent firm coupled with the vast resources of a major financial institution.
Good to see you, Neil.
How was your weekend?
My weekend was excellent. How about yours?
Well, it was great. For me, as a retired person, the weekend goes on today.
You know, what is that like to have a weekend be every day?
Well, it's great.
You know the Garfield cartoon that says, I hate Mondays? that's not the case for you, right?
No. And I don't know, what does the expression Wednesday is hump day mean? I don't get that. I used to know what it meant.
Well, you know, Thursday is now Friday Junior.
Right, right. Although, you know, when I was a kid, I used to be afraid of Sunday nights because...
that's a common childhood anxiety that kids have. It's
right,
real.
Right. I'm still scared of Sunday nights. Some of the shows.
I feel like you were getting into something a little more deep.
Can I lie
so
down?
Do we have some articles?
Can I lie down and talk about this? Well, if you think that's a weird comment, wait until you hear this article. This article is called Capitalism's Inevitable Cycle of Boom or Bust. And what Jason Swig of Wall Street Journal discusses is how there has been a constant regulation of financial institutions and deregulation that accompanied cyclical swings. And he begins his analysis with the laws of Eshnua, which was 4,200 years ago in Mesopotamia, where the maximal allowed interest rate was set along with loans for silver and for barley. And then he goes on to analyze the reign of Emperor Tiberius in AD 14, which was Roman usury laws. And then he shows how if you take a look at banking crisis of 1819, 1826, 1837, 1839, blah, 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 they all were as a result of a financial collapse, which then resulted in tightening of regulation, which then caused everything to stabilize. The economy grew. And then when the economy was very successful, they began to lighten up on regulations. And he said that's exactly what happened in 2008. And the conclusion is, quote, regulation is in retreat. Interest rates look like likely to rise. This may be about as good a time as it gets for banks. Every deregulation cycle just plants the seeds for re-regulation.
It's true. And it's that pendulum swinging. You know, a great example is after 2008 is this fiduciary rule, which is basically with the new administration coming in, has gone to the wayside. And that's one regulation that is about really protecting the end consumer. Many of the regulations, you know, we all like to complain about, you know, if you're purchasing a home, you know, at one point the paperwork went from, you know, can you fog a mirror in, you know, 2006 to then, you know, a ream of paper of all these disclosures and needing to get qualified. It's the pendulum swinging, and it's the human nature, and a lot of it also has to do with behavioral finance. It's behavioral finance, but in a different way. People can't help but to be constantly trying to protect themselves or ensure it doesn't happen again, whatever just happened, without truly looking at the whole picture and saying, how can we create regulations that will be good in boom and bust cycles?
Well, that was very well put. And, you know, I think what you should do if you use that at a cocktail party to discuss the economic cycles, throw in the laws of Eshnua.
In this article, Jason Schwig must have had some serious time on his hands. He went back
time.
Pretty far.
Serious time. And you know what? We should research whether in Mesopotamia 4,200 years ago, the maximum interest rate on barley was 33.3%.
I'll leave that to you. You every day's a weekend for you. You have some spare time.
So here's a surprise for you. I have another article by Jason Swig from the Wall Street Journal. And this actually has a little bit more relevance, not that much, but a little bit more relevance. What he is looking at here is how with the tremendous growth of index funds, there has been, you know, index funds means that the indexes have to, the people who run the index funds have to buy all the stocks in the index.
Yeah, they have to track the index.
Right. So what gets lost here is that, you know, people who participate in index funds, you know, will get Apple, and they'll get Amazon, they'll get Facebook, and they'll get all of the big stocks. But there are some stocks that are left out because they're not in any index. And there have been a couple of portfolio managers that Swig has interviewed that said that there is an opportunity here to buy stocks that are not in any index fund because they're being ignored. And, you know, one of my favorite writers in the financial world in the last 15 years
is Jason Swig.
No, besides Jason Swig, he's a reporter. One of my favorite writers is Taleb, who wrote Black Swan. And the conclusion of his book was that the best way to invest is to put like 90% of your money in treasury bills and then take the other 5 or 10% and put it into things that have a potential of becoming, the stocks have a potential of becoming a black swan on the upside. And in a sense, this is what this article is saying, is that, yes, you should invest in an ETF, but there are certain stocks that are excluded from ETFs that haven't done as well that may make sense. And some of them are called micro caps, too small, too risky. But if you have this same, as Taleb said, this barbell thing where, you know, it's balanced between 90% that is risk-free and, you know, 10% that maybe has a little bit of risk, it could be an interesting way of structuring your portfolio.
Well, on the Taleb front, you know, well, first let's finish up this article because I think the article's title actually says it all. On the random walk, pick up a few orphans. Mm-hmm. You know, that's basically a diversification strategy. Mm-hmm. Taleb, though, you know, I'd like to challenge you on that, Neil, because really what you're saying there is, or what I think Taleb was saying, what you're saying to our listeners is such a great idea.
You blame everything Taleb says on me, don't you?
To say 90% of it in a risk-free, like a treasury, and then gamble with the 10% for what you think is going to have an amazing upside. I think a more prudent advice would be to have a diversified portfolio where you do have some risk-free, but you do have it's not as black and white as Taleb in his Black Swan book likes to point it out.
That's why you're my financial advisor.
Well, thankfully.
I didn't say you should do it. I just said that this
the implication that you should do it.
Well, it was his conclusion. And he's done very well, by the way.
Selling books.
Selling
exactly.
books. speaking of financial advisors, this I think is an interesting article, and it is about what you should avoid when you hire a financial advisor. And it says there are three types of financial advisors. This is from MarketWatch, by the way, that you should avoid. And here's something that maybe you can opine on. The first is the novice advisor, which is kind of unfortunate because it's. I'm sure it's true, but of course, how do you become experienced if you're not going to be able to get any clients? But he said the novice advisor is not a great choice to make. The second he said was.
Well, I think with the novice advisor, what this article is missing is that usually people starting out in the industry are willing to do the research, willing to do the hard work to figure out the answers for you. So I think if you're looking at somebody who's a novice, you need to look at somebody who's also smart and also willing to do the hard work to make it happen.
True. And, you know, there's no reason why a novice can't get experience working with somebody. You do have people working for you who are...
Well, everybody has to start somewhere.
Yeah. And the second is a highly... This would eliminate me from...
Clearly, a highly opinionated...
Highly opinionated person is not a good choice.
And on that one, I think that there's two sides to that coin as well, because you need to have somebody who's directive. People are looking for advice. They're not looking for a yes person to just validate, because you're not doing your job if you're just validating whatever dreams and whims. I joke sometimes that there are some meetings that you come out of with clients and you feel like you're a dream killer, because you have to tell them the honest truth of what their finances can support in whatever their dreams are.
He ends the section with a quote from John Kenneth Galbraith. The quote is, "The function of economic forecasting is to make astrology look respectable." And the last, because we got to run here, the last is a salesperson. That is, you don't want to, spot a salesperson a mile away. And that's not what you want. You don't want a salesperson as your advisor. Those are the three things he says.
Well, you want somebody who I think the important things are: someone that you can trust, someone that's going to be working in your best interests, and someone who's going to take the time to listen to you and find out what your dreams and wants are. Because oftentimes, you know, what my clients want versus what I want, it wouldn't be my life choices, but it's not my life and it's not my money. And so I am there to help them figure out what they can use their money for whatever their dreams are, whether it be golf, and I don't particularly like to golf, or whether it be travel.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back. Money Talk, brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending. Since 1988, a mortgage banker and direct lender that believes in providing in-depth loan consulting to its customers in a personalized and honest manner.
Yes, and we are thrilled to have Ben Mascari in studio with us. He's the CEO and founder of Serigraph Resortwear. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
So, Ben, tell us a little bit about what Serigraph Resortwear is, and then we'll talk a little bit how you got there.
Well, Serigraph Resortwear is a company that does resort wear that supplies about 850 accounts throughout the United States and the Caribbean. And these are generally mom-and-pop accounts, and we supply them resort, tourist t-shirts, sweatshirts, garments, and they're in really tourist
destinations,
and you'll see that, and you'll see like a generic design that says Nantucket, but you could go to Hilton Head or Maui, Hawaii, or Alaska and see the same type of design. That's our specialty.
So where did this concept come from? How did you get into resort wear? Because I can't imagine you graduated from college and said, "Oh, this is what I want to do."
I graduated from college, and Serigraph's been around since 1976, and I started it. I started working for Bill Bowles, who's still in town here, and he said, "Come work for me, and you can take it over." So I started in '87, and I bought him out in 2000, and that's
how
we did it. So it's
perfect.
Been good.
And now it's a family business. Your wife Carrie is also involved, right?
Carrie's involved too. We've every now and then we open up retail stores, be it on State Street or be it on Linden Avenue in Carpinteria. And we dabble into the retail game. Mainly we
supply.
So
what made you do that?
Well, opportunity. When the right rent comes up and the right location comes up, then we say, look, we have this opportunity because we're going from manufacturing to retail. So it's a nice fit for us.
Do customers get upset with that? Do you have customers in Santa Barbara?
I have very few customers anymore in Santa Barbara, but you're right. This is not a normal thing for me to do, because my customer base, if I'd start opening up things in Newport Beach or Pismo, they would be upset and they would go somewhere else. But that's a very good point.
And do you do work for hotels too?
Well, the hotel gift shops and things like that.
So you put do you do labeling like for hotels so and so?
I could do some of that. I do some custom work and I could do some logo work and things like that. But that's not my niche. My niche is to develop my own designs and then have my set reps that go out there and sell them throughout the United States.
Are they your reps or are they?
Our reps. So they're independent contractors. They might rep 3 to 6 different lines.
So in terms of when you made that decision to move from wholesaling basically and manufacturing into that retail space, you first opened a store in Carpinteria.
Right. Well, we've had some stores along State Street when the rent was right and the atmosphere was right.
But so really, when I think about the problems that we're facing here on State Street in terms of so many vacancies, that's really prime for somebody like yourself to do a now, would you call it a pop-up store?
I would definitely call it a pop-up store. Located on State Street in a really good block, and I just opened it 2 months ago, so I'm on State Street for another, 3 months, and it's a pop-up store, and it might be extended, it might not, but the landlord was willing to work with me on a pop-up, which I think is good, because when you have 30-plus vacancy on State Street, landlords are kind of keeping their eyebrows up, like, can we rent this to anybody?
And a few weeks back, we had a businesswoman on the show who owns commercial real estate. And what she says is the most important thing to do when looking for tenants is to really make sure that they are quality tenants. And I think that your hybrid really makes you a unique case in that you own both the wholesale division as well as a retail shop. You're definitely going to be able to pay your bills.
Yeah, well, one of the probably incentives to this landlord, I said, I'd just write the check all up front. Here's your 3 months, here's your 4 months. And that's awfully nice. But it's hard for people to make it on State Street, especially mom and pops with the kind of rent that they want to charge for the leases. It's
so now when
not
you go
easy.
In, do you negotiate down the rents? Because the rents per square foot are quite extremely high. How many t-shirts can you sell to make that work?
You can't throw them in the bags fast enough. I mean, it's so incredibly high, some of the rents on State Street. And they can get them with the national chains and things like that, because I believe the national chains can lose money just for being on State Street and being in that location and having their brand out there.
Right. They can chalk it up to a brand or marketing expense right. as opposed to anything else.
If that's their plan, they better rethink it, because many companies now have decided, looking at their profits on Madison Avenue in Paris, they're saying maybe this isn't such a smart idea. A lot of companies are taking a hard look at the loss leader retail locations. And so I hope that's plan C, not plan B for State Street here.
I think that should be plan C also. Yes. It's interesting. This location's been open up for maybe a month now. And my other location on State Street was on Lower State Street, and I closed it maybe a year and a half ago, maybe 3 years ago now. And I definitely notice a different atmosphere on State Street in 3 years. There's a lot more homeless, and it's, people talk about it, and I don't know the solution at all. I'm kind of just downing.
you're like, don't ask me the follow-up question solution, on that, Diane.
Yeah. But I see it on the street, and, before anything goes on, I think that's a key thing that they need to address also.
But that's why pop-up stores make sense, because pop-up stores help to eliminate some of the homelessness, because if you have an empty store, the homeless tend to stand in that little area of the doorway.
And I think it's a distinction. It's less of the homeless as the they kind of fit into three categories: the mentally ill, the vagrant, person who's going around. And it's really the vagrants that are causing more of the issues.
Yeah, I just don't know. I'm just looking at it from the outside, going
right.
There's more of it.
Do you have trouble hiring people if you're just in business for 3-4 months? Is there a pool of labor here that you can get on a spur of the moment?
There is a pool of labor, especially in the summertime, because I can draw from the high school kids, and I have kids too, so I can have their friends and friends of family. So I do have a pool that I can get. But if it was in the fall or winter, it would be a little harder. I'd have to go to the city college and pull that pool.
And you already have all the equipment, so there's no capital investment?
No capital investment. I have all the racks and things like that, and I have the t-shirts down in my warehouse. I just put Santa Barbara. I know the designs that work. So, my startup cost is very, very small.
One of the things about being a really good guest on a radio show is to bring the host and hostess a free t-shirt. Well, and even the engineer.
I'm a rookie at this, so maybe next time.
Maybe next time. I think on that note,
We'll
take a break. You're listening to Money Talk on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station. We'll be right back. Back to Money Talk brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial guidance.
And if you're just joining us, we have Ben Mascari in studio with us, who's the president and CEO of Serigraph Resortwear. And he also has two retail locations, one in Santa Barbara and one in Carpinteria locally. And so what I wanted to ask you, Ben, before the break, we were talking about, you know, some of the issues that you see with that's facing State Street. Now, when you compare and contrast that to what you, the store that you have down on Linden Ave and Carpinteria, what similarities and differences do you see between the two locations?
Well, one difference is there's not as much homelessness down in Carpinteria. There are some, but it's not as in your face as it is on State Street. They're two very good tourist locations, so our shirts work in both locations, which is nice. And there's people out. People are traveling. You know, I expect the hotel occupancy to be as good as last year, or if not better. So there's people out there, and they want to shop. They just want to feel safe. And I think they feel a little safer in Carpinteria than they do in Santa Barbara.
Well, it does have the world's safest beach, right?
Or that might
something
help
like that title. So now in Carpinteria, that isn't a pop-up store, though. That's a
no. That's an ongoing store.
So it's 12 months a year in Carpinteria.
Yes, exactly.
And now, do you see? You must see a significant drop off from the summer to the winter months.
Oh yes.
Do you still do business in those winter months?
We still do business. They have that state park that's right down the street, and that's pretty full all weekends. The campers come up and things like that. So that's a good draw for the Carpinteria local businesses.
Where do you make your your shirts?
In Carpinteria.
So from a standpoint of your shipping, you ship UPS or whatever all
yes.
over the country?
All over the country. UPS, freight lines, FedEx.
And do you do the new order to demand, or are you shipping, you know, the whole summer to some to South Carolina, or do you help them by shipping, you know, when they need it?
We are as needed. So we'll put in a big order at the beginning of their season, be it South Carolina, come, you know, our ship would be March 15th, and we'll put it in, and then they'll reorder upon what sells. And then the beauty about our business at the wholesale level is we have quick turnarounds for them, so they don't have to stock up with 1,000 shirts. They can reorder at 48s or 72 of a design. So that's really helps all the mom and pops.
So do you have like Hilton Head Island in a computer? It's not like a whole setup. If you want to do some Hilton Head Island t-shirts and you just finished
Martha's Vineyard
mm-hmm. t-shirts, you can just hit some keys?
It's a actual mechanical press. It's not a computer. Uh-huh. So it's actually silk screening onto the shirts. So what happens is we'll pop out the Martha's Vineyard screen and put in the Hilton Head screen, but the other screens that have the six-color design all stay the same. And so we're just taking one screen out and putting the other screen in.
So because your designs are the same, you're
right.
able to make it much more economical for you to produce, and you can produce quicker.
Very good.
So that's really the part of the secrets of your profit margins.
Right.
That's
and
also
a niche.
The niche that you serve. You're not serving these huge stores.
Right. I'm not going to a Costco, or I'm not going to a huge chain that will whittle me down on the price or want it, you know, and have terms of 120 days. I'm doing the mom and pops that need quick turnaround and low minimums.
So do you have any problem with receivables?
I do have some problems with receivables. You know, the hurricane last year in the Caribbean really knocked me out for a while with all the St. Martin and St. John and St. Thomas accounts. But they've been around with me for 15, 20 years. And I just say, look, you know, when your insurance comes in, you can pay. And for the most part, I got a lot of that receivables back, but it took me 120 days, 200 days, but most of it came back.
So, and that also gives them a sense that you care about them. It's goodwill.
Yeah, it is. And I do care about them because they got devastated. So,
well, and it's a lot like what we saw here in Montecito this past winter.
Yeah.
And I think it goes a long way having people working, having relationships and working with people as people, because you know, everybody, it's life and everybody goes through ups and downs. And that really shows that you're a true business partner to these people.
For sure. I know a lot of my accounts personally, and it's 800 accounts, but I know them by name. I can get them on the phone, you know, and it's fun because I've been doing it for so long. It's good to see these people a couple times a year and just catch up. So,
do you give them a choice of the quality of the T-shirts?
Well, not really, because we're on a higher end of the T-shirt market. We're not selling the 3 for $10s or anything like that. Our unit cost, average unit cost that goes out is about $10.25 a unit. So they're retailing them anywhere from $22.95 to $27.95. So it's more of a higher end tourist T-shirt kind of situation. So I don't give them a choice too much. I go source the garments. And we bring them in and we do the designs and they look at it and say, yes, this is going to retail for me.
So one of your large costs then is your inventory. You're buying obviously in bulk, so you've got a whole warehouse full of T-shirts.
Yeah, exactly right. You know, you have carrying costs on that inventory, and you have to have that inventory in stock. So when they call up and they want a quick turnaround, you have to be able just to pull it off the shelf and print up their shirts and ship them out.
And do you source it from one company or more?
No, a lot of different companies. Yeah, a lot of different companies.
Now, will these tariffs that are going on in the news right now affect your business in terms of being able to source your products?
Yeah, probably. I think that a couple of the companies are United States-based, and then the other ones in Vietnam, and one's in Bangladesh. So I don't really pull anything from China quite yet, but, you know, eventually.
Or maybe not even eventually, yeah, depending exactly. upon where these tariffs go.
Exactly. So, you know, I've been dodging so far, but eventually it might hit us.
So is there a price differential between American-made T-shirts and Vietnamese?
It just depends on the manufacturer and the quality. And that's more that I'm looking for. Like, I have relationships with my customers. I have relationships with my suppliers too, and that means more to me than 50 cents or 25 cents a unit or something like that. So I tend to just have a relationship that I know I'm going to get shipped on time, and they're going to come through with what they say they're going to do. So, but yeah, there's a difference.
So I don't want to make too much of this, but, you know, what you're really saying is sort of a major story here, and that is the Trump administration and, quite frankly, so much of the textile business in the last 25 years in America have said, we can't compete with, first it was China, now it's with Vietnam or Bangladesh. But you're saying that the differential is not that great between an American and a foreign-made textile.
Well, they're right when they say that, because the labor costs that's in Guatemala and the labor costs that's in Bangladesh are nowhere close to the labor costs that's going to be in the United States. So they can't compete doing it that way. But there's other ways to compete. If you're just buying it from a United States company as opposed to buying it from a company in Bangladesh, there's no way they can compete.
So how do they compete? How do American companies compete then?
Well, American companies compete because they put in Made in the USA fully, and they can charge more for that because there's people out there and my customer base out there that want that. So that's a thing that is
people are willing to pay a premium for that
for
made in the USA.
Exactly.
Right, like there's jeans companies that's like made in LA, you know what I mean?
Thing. Yeah.
Well, you know, that's the sort of nuance that I wish, not to get it political here, I wish our government would take into account when they make these decisions that are going to upset the trade.
Do we have to pull out the Neil Chrysell for president slogan again?
I'm sorry. But I think that's interesting that there are, you know, it's not, unless it's a true commodity, you know, like steel where it's not labeled, there is differences in product quality, and there's differences in panache. You know, people want the USA name, and so we are competing, and I think that's something that should be on the table of when the governments decide what they're going to do to help American businesses. Some of them don't need the help that they're getting right now.
Right. And so Ben, would you say that the American-made products are of a higher quality than the internationally made products?
I would say in some of the styles that I carry, for sure. And in the other styles, you can't tell the difference.
You can't tell the difference.
Yeah. So it just depends on which styles that we're talking about. But yes, in some instances, there is a much better quality.
And so given your niche, you know, how much do you think that e-commerce is a factor? You know, you're kind of a tourist. You're an impulse buy as opposed to, oh, I need this T-shirt, you know, for the rest of my life.
Well, that's interesting. Most of the mom and pops that we deal with, they are not even on, they don't have a website, and they still fax in orders. So they're not quite there.
What's a fax?
Yeah, what's a fax machine?
He has faxed to email.
Yeah, exactly.
It comes in and then it's in his email box.
So, no, it hasn't hit yet, but it might. But I just think that people are on vacation, they're feeling good about where they're at, and they want to remember it somehow. Be it a postcard, be it a magnet, be it a mug, be it a T-shirt. And it's an easy kind of impulse buy, as you say.
Do you ever consider getting into the business where there is some comment made politically and it's a great line and you see the T-shirt comes out an hour later with the same line that, when Senator... the majority leader in the Senate said that Elizabeth Warren she wouldn't shut up, and so everyone had a T-shirt saying she wouldn't shut up. Is that something that you don't want to get into that business?
Well, there's a lot of different niches in our business. There's a lot of different much bigger screen printers that don't even dabble in the resort market. They go to, you know, the college bookstore market
or the
concert T-shirt business, or so. The margins are a little thin on those.
Well, and I've got to imagine the same for sporting goods, because when you have like a Super Bowl or something, they print everything as if both teams won, and then chuck it to, I don't know where they do with the unused goods.
Yeah, hopefully I'm going to have a cheap New England Patriots Super Bowl T-shirt, because they're going to lose this year.
Hey, let's not go there.
I'll work on that for your gift.
Exactly. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Cota Street in downtown Santa Barbara.
So, Ben, let's talk a little bit about retail stores, because it seems like you have your pulse on what works and what doesn't in your business. And it feels like there are many retail shops that are just unable to make it for some reason. You know, and it's not just in Santa Barbara, though, because we are in Santa Barbara, we feel as if, you know, we're the center of, it's everywhere, really. Do you think, are there some key operational issues that people continue, or mistakes that people continue to make?
I think there's an old saying, location, location, location. And for the resort wear market, you can make a lot of mistakes and not be the best business person, but if you're in the location that the tourists are at, you're going to do well. So that's even opposite of what you're saying.
Right, and I guess part of it is when I look at State Street, obviously it's a very long corridor that, you know, retail today wouldn't be perhaps set up in the same fashion that State Street is today. But at the same time, you think about, there are still tourists on it. Every weekend that I'm on State Street, I never know anybody. On a Wednesday, I know everybody.
Right, exactly.
And so there's still tourists there. And so aside from location, is there any advice that you can maybe give to people listening that are thinking about a retail operation?
I would know the numbers. I would know your margins. I know where your, you know, profit centers are coming from, and concentrate on those when you're actually opened up and see what the sales are, because you want to expand on what is, you know, throwing off more income per square foot, as opposed to, oh, that looks good and I really like those things because I personally like them.
Right. So I can see how that could be a big
problem.
So you
have to take your personal likes out of the retail, and unless those personal likes are selling really well, then you do more of it. So people like to put things in that they like, which is a mistake, only if it sells.
Right. That is true. I can see that that's an easy stumbling block.
And do you have computer programs to know which ones of your designs are selling in general and B in specific areas?
Oh, for sure.
So you can make adjustments to that.
Oh, yes. And we do. Yeah. It's fun. And those same reports that come out, we tell reps in the different regions, look, this might have a palm tree on it, but we can put a pine tree on it and, you know, readjust this design for your location up in Lake Placid. And they tend to sell well just with the little tweaks on them, too. So, but we have those reports come out, and I look at those quite often.
So I've got to imagine in your business, inventory control and that data and stats and numbers really make or break what you're sourcing and what you're going to have in stock in your warehouse. So how much you know money do you invest in those types of programs? I should ask. I'm assuming it's all computerized.
It's all computerized. Yes, I was very fortunate. And I went with the company that wrote a really specific software that was for the resort embroiderers and screen printers. And it had all the different nuances that we needed. So it was basically like somebody custom wrote a software program for me. And I got on really early, and they're still in business. And I've had almost the same software since 1991, and they've upgraded through the years, and it's been a
wow.
Nice,
that's a unique story.
That's a nice long run, and right. I'm crossing my fingers.
Right, gosh,
to keep
well,
it
that's
going.
Wonderful.
Yeah, and it works really well.
Perfect.
So that's kind of been a nice, you know, benefit that I've picked
right.
up.
Right. So have you ever toyed with, you know, outsourcing your screen printing versus doing it in Carpinteria in a coastal community where square footage is expensive?
Exactly. Yes, I just don't know if I move my operation down to Oxnard or, you know, somewhere where there's cheaper rent and, you know, lower costs, or to Nevada or to Florida or Texas. I could do that operation from any state, but my quality of life would be so much less. So I've chose not to do that. And I'm pretty much a hands-on kind of person. So outsourcing might sound romantic and jazzy, but I like to have control over what goes out and when it goes out. And when I promise my customers it's going out by Friday and you'll have it on Tuesday, I don't want to hear an excuse from my person that I'm outsourcing the printing from saying, oh, I couldn't get it to you on Friday, it's going to have to be next Tuesday, because I wouldn't like that, and I know my customers wouldn't like that. So I might be giving up a few dollars here and there, but my quality of life is good, and I get to live in Santa Barbara, and I get to raise my family. So, you know, I got that going for me.
And so how many jobs do you create in Carpinteria and Santa Barbara for our community?
Oh, well, in the warehouse, there's 20 employees down there, and then there's 5 to 6 at the Carpinteria location and 5 to 6 at the Santa Barbara location. So.
And really, I often think that the unsung heroes are small business in our community, because everyone gets really excited when a really large employer comes to town and thinks about how many jobs are being created. But really, it's the mom and pops like yourself that you're employing anywhere from 20 to 40 people that are really the engine that drives our economy.
For sure. Most of my employees have been with me for, and not in the retail stores, but in my manufacturing, been with me for more than 20 years. I mean, I just have them there.
And wow.
It's a really nice little family unit down there, and I must be doing something wrong. I know there's a lot more turnaround in my business.
What do you do about health insurance?
Health insurance is offered, and, you know, some of them take it and some of them don't, depending on what their spouses and other people have in place.
Well, so. What you mean it's offered? Is it part of the ACA, or do you have private health insurance? How do you navigate that?
Oh, it's what year are you talking about? Because it changes.
Yeah,
it changes all the time, and that the problem is it changes so much that you know, it's hard. You have to have a good person, you know, that's providing you the healthcare to give you all the different, you
details
know, regulations and the details and things like that. So,
yeah,
it's,
and you're
it's
still
tough.
Under the 50 person.
Under the 50 person. So I don't have to. But
rule,
we do.
Right.
Yeah.
That's great. That's a great benefit, because it's something that people need, yeah. Especially as we, you know, healthcare costs are skyrocketing, and, you know, it's a real issue facing many small business. I can speak from our my own company, Arlington, is our health insurance premiums every year for the last 3 years have gone up 15%.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's
there's yeah, it's tough.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So, you know, in terms of foot traffic for the retail stores. Now, you have two Santa Barbara locations now. You have mm-hmm. one in the Funk Zone, right?
I don't know if that's, it's kind of a stall. It's a location, and it's really a really nice location. It's inside the, it's called the Shops at the Waterfront, Waterline, Shops at the Waterline. And it's inside the Topa Topa Llama Dog building and the Blair Fox Winery. And in the back, there's stalls, and you rent out these stalls, and you put up your T-shirts or the other vendors that are there, and they supply the employee. So I don't have an employee there. So I get a computer report every day of what's sold, and then I go back in there and then restock. So it's a kind of an interesting concept that they rent out stalls. The square footage is a little bit more expensive, but you don't have an employee.
Interesting. So who pays for that employee?
The people that I rent from.
Oh, interesting.
They're the building owners.
And so far, you've seen that as being successful and working?
I think that's working. I think the Funk Zone is the Funk Zone's a little different because I don't see as much, much as the homeless in that little area of the Funk Zone that I'm in. So it's kind of weird, and it's more of a local. Not a big tourist destination. It's more of a locals destination. So the garments and the things that I have there are a little bit more geared towards the locals. So that could be a year-round kind of location.
And how long have you been in that location?
Since April 1st.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back with our final segment. Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
And if you're just joining us, we have Ben Mascari, who's the owner of Serigraft Resort Wear, who is both a wholesaler and a retailer for resort wear. So, Ben, you know, in our closing segment, I just want to kind of talk to you a little bit about what you see as some trends in retail of your space, because your space is really unique in that it isn't recession-proof because people don't go on vacation if there's a recession. But are you seeing a peak? Are you seeing – is it back to pre-2007 numbers? Where are you seeing things at?
It's definitely back to the numbers of pre-2007. And it's still growing this year. Most of my accounts throughout the nation are up, and they're upbeat, and the reorders are really good right now. So the wholesale side is really strong, and I see it still being strong in the next couple of years. So, and it's a really fun thing because I have a pulse on a lot of different regions of the country. It's just not Santa Barbara. It's just not Southern California. So I foresee this kind of run going for at least another couple of years.
And when you look at the numbers, is there any way for you to tell, probably not through your wholesale business, but through your retail shops, what percentage are international travelers versus U.S.? Is there any number or data? I'm not sure.
I can't track that really because I'm not at all the mom and pop retailers.
Right.
So I can't really track that. And people say, oh, you want a weak dollar. So most of the dollar stays here. And they don't travel abroad. You don't want a strong dollar. And then, you know, if you have a weak dollar, all the Europeans or international will come here. So I look at that sometimes, and I can't make heads or tails of it.
Right. Well, it's funny because last night we were walking on State Street, and I think I heard like 16 languages, and none of them were English.
Right.
You know, so it was definitely international here last night.
But that's a good thing.
Right.
For Santa Barbara.
It's what Santa Barbara really needs. You know, I think we count on those tax revenue dollars.
Yeah.
And so, do you see any ways that the city could help alleviate some of our retail issues? Because no matter who you speak to, there are always differing opinions of
right.
who can do what.
Yeah.
Do you see any obvious things that we're missing here locally that we could help fix?
I think they should try some different things, especially on State Street. I think they need to think outside the box. You look at like Pearl Street in Boulder, where they closed it off for X amount of sections, or you look at the Third Street Promenade down in Santa Monica. You know, that wasn't booming at all, and then they closed it off, and it generated more foot traffic because people were able to walk just on the street. So, you know, I would try that for a weekend or two weekends and promote that and just see how that goes for a while. There's no parking on State Street, so you're not taking away any parking. So, and then let the vendors come out into the street a little bit and maybe let some people do some carts in the middle of the street. And well, the city could generate some revenue.
Well, thank you, Ben. Thank you for being here. And I'm looking forward to your next visit because you were a very good guest and because I'm going to get a free T-shirt.
I got to go now.
Ben, thanks so much for being here.
You've been listening to Money Talk. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.